this talk is going to be all over the place. I'll try to relate it to some of the things we heard before. Basically, the point of my story here, and as you can see, this is joint work with many people who are actually sitting in the room, and many others were not mentioned. We have been involved over the last few years in trying to build methods to put geometry on digital data. So for us, digital data are basically points, basically clouds of points in Euclidean space, but not necessarily so, as you will see. And the issue is basically to build geometries on the data that somehow allow us to get it organized. Okay? And getting it organized may depend very much on the goal that we have in mind. You know, different tasks require different organizations. And so the issue is, how does one tune this notion, and what does it mean to get it organized? So what happened over the last few years is that sort of basically by introducing sort of conventional tools of harmonic analysis into the mix, a lot of organizational methodology sort of seemed to have emerged. So my goal today is basically tell you how basically raw data defines its own internal intrinsic structure. So ontology, it defines ontologies of its on itself and defines in some sense a very rudimentary language of itself. So I'd like to sort of explain that. I will not go too much into the detailed mathematics, but explain the broad outline. Many of the details you have heard at other talks here, and this is fine. So basically, one of the insights that came about from this sort of information revolution over the last 5 or 10 years is that the knowledge or information is basically in the network of connection of an object with other objects. Okay, so the network itself carries with it a lot of information about meaning. This is standard in linguistics, right? If you take a word, the meaning of the word is really contextual. It depends on how it's being used, what it is linked to at a given time. Okay, the word itself could have many, many meanings depending on the different contexts that it is being used in, right? Winning in sports is not the same as winning in the war, or winning in a trial or other situation. There are various subtle differences. Okay, so basically trying to encapsulate knowledge by building various networks or subnetworks or folders is really one thing that arose. The social networks of inferences between digital documents, whether they're text or proteins or sensor outputs, they characterize their function. And we have seen this, in fact, the social network of a gene as it relates to documents and it relates to function and other things. All of those connections really give you the information so that you can do inferences. Now, at the end of the day, we basically want to reach conclusion. Conclusions, I would say, is here as a diagnostic estimate, which is basically a function on the database of information. And the issue is, how does one take such functions and basically approximate them from known samples, extrapolate their values elsewhere, and so on. So basically, this is harmonic analysis. How do you take a function and expand it, if you wish? So this is a picture stolen out of Amit's presentation, but it's a really nice picture. Because the issue is this, we have this, let's pretend for a second that we have this puzzle we need to assemble, okay? There are two ways of doing it, and I'm going to talk about both of them this talk. One is to build a graph, in other words, for each piece of the puzzle in some feature space, relate that piece to other pieces of the puzzle. And hopefully, very nearby, there will be strong affinity between pieces that fit together, okay? When you do that, you build that graph. If you've done it correctly, this particular graph would have the property that the first eigenfunctions of the affinity matrix between the puzzle pieces will be the x, y, z coordinate So the first three eigenfunctions of that particular graph will actually solve the puzzle. Well, that's not the way we do it. Okay? In our brain, we don't find eigenfunctions of some affinity operator. Okay? The way we would do it is very simple, right? We will take a piece of the puzzle and we'll build, look at the ones that fit around it. This will give us a little patch. Then we'll look at other pieces, try to assemble another patch, have all kinds of little patches of a few pieces, and then we will take, say, this collection of patches and fit them together, and gradually, so by build this whole structure, by sort of assembling it into bigger and bigger folders, if you wish. So there are two ways of solving that puzzle. And so one is sort of, I would call it the bookkeeping librarian way, and the other one is the mathematician's way, which is find eigenvectors. So find eigenvectors is very, very nice, but it's too mysterious because you don't really understand what it does. It's a very nice way of computing, but it doesn't really tell you what are the nuts and bolts of this. And that's an issue. The two things, and I'll address that, are very tightly related. So an example of that puzzle is, again, something that either Yoel or Amit talked about. By the way, this is exactly the globe puzzle you've seen before. This is what's happening in cryomicroscopy. You have a molecule which may have this shape out here on the right-hand side. It may have a few thousand atoms. And the way you image the molecule is basically that you freeze, say, 10,000 exemplars of that molecule in a little film of water, in a block of ice, and you take X-ray microscopy of them so that you're seeing the molecule, which looks like this thing here. You're seeing a absorption in different direction, depends how it's disposed. So this is a puzzle. So each one of the pictures here is this piece of is an orientation of this particular molecule in different positions, except they're random. So you don't know. It's exactly the puzzle we've seen before. So you don't know how it all fits together, so to speak. So the point is that it fits together by looking at who nearest neighbors are. If you do the right kind of geometry, you can arrange it in such a way that the XYZ coordinate of the graph of all those pictures are going to be exactly the orientation of the molecule relative to the beam of the X-ray. And then you can reconstruct. So here is a situation where it's the total networks that give you the assembly of the pieces, and not by taking the way it's conventionally done. You take each one, you try to find any features in that, and try to decide what the orientation is, and you estimate one at a time. Here you're looking at the global structure of everybody as they relate to everybody else, so to speak. And so the simplest version of this affinity algorithm of data, so suppose you have a collection of data points, I'm going to just give two or three basic statements on how you deal with general data, and then we'll sort of merge into the rest of my talk. So generally speaking, the point is the following. One way of building a coordinate system on data, or getting data organized from local affinity between it, is written out here. Suppose you have a collection of digital documents. So each xi here represents some vector in high dimensions. It could be, each xi could be a text document or an image, for that matter. The images we had before, each one of the images I had before was an image, so it was a document. If it was a 100 by 100 image, it's a vector in 10,000 dimensions. And then I can take dot products between those vectors, and you can normalize them to have lengths 1, compute the cosine of the angle between them, which is what we've seen in the last talk, and think of that as a way of deciding what the affinity, how similar those things are. Again, the problem in high dimension is that this is usually totally meaningless unless that affinity is very, very close to 1. Okay? If they're almost the same, then you're actually saying, well, they're almost the same. Okay? Beyond that, they're very far. They go, when you move them just a little bit from each other, they go way out there. So you take this affinity matrix and you truncate it only to the values I and j, which are practically the same. So you can decide, well, let me keep all of those correlations here if they are very close to one, let's say larger than 0.95, and set them to zero otherwise. Okay, so I ignore the rest of the universe. Here, this was done by essentially doing it in a smooth, gentle way. If the dot product between xi and xj is within epsilon from one, you get something, and if it's much bigger than epsilon, you get zero. If this difference is much bigger than, so epsilon could be 0.01 or something. So you get this symmetric matrix. You can take this matrix and convert it to a stochastic matrix in a variety of different ways, and then diagonalize it. So diagonalizing it just means that you write it as a combination. So think of T as being, at this point, A is just the same matrix as zero, just you have renormalized it in some way. And then think of T is equal to one, then you can write a summation of its eigenvalues, which are lambda L to the power two, because it's a positive matrix. And the eigenvectors are phi L I, but since I corresponds to some point xi in space, I might as well write this eigenvectors as a function of that particular point. And so this is basically, this matrix is rewritten this way. The power t of that matrix is a to the power t has entries at xi xj. So this is some abuse of notation. Then you can embed, so the organizational miracle really is that I've done nothing. This is some sort of, I would call it, reduced version of multidimensional scaling, which is you look at the matrix of distances, or here it's distances on the unit sphere, and then diagonalize it, which is usually called multidimensional scaling. But here I'm restricting only to those pairs for which this is reliable. And so you look at the eigenvectors of that, which is what you do in multidimensional scaling, and embed the point xi into the point in Euclidean space whose coordinate are the lambda l to the power t scaled correctly times this. Now, the reason there is a t here is that the eigenvalues are always between 0 and 1. If t is large, this stops very quickly, and you have a low-dimensional embedding of the data. The other observation is that if you interpret the AT as some sort of probability of transition from xi to xj in the data, or the affinity between xi and xj in the data, there is a natural distance attached to that, which is you can compute from that matrix, which is really the distance between the embedded poles. Okay, so this is identically equal to that, it's just algebra. So this is almost all the mathematics I'm going to do. This distance here, which I've written here, depends on the parameter t, which is t represents, when I look at a to the power t, this is t is equal to 1, it's a probability from going in one time step from xi to xj. When t is equal to 10, it would be the probability of going in 10 time step between xi and xj through a diffusion process, which is defined by this stochastic matrix A, which I built here. So if you want some intuition about what's happening here, why is this distance that I've defined a little bit better than conventional distances? That's explained in this particular picture, which some of you have seen many, many times, which is if I define, suppose this is a collection of documents. In this picture, my documents is a shrub in some shrub area. And I really want to know, I say that, or this could be a population, and I want to know, define a distance between points, which will tell me basically their affinity in this network of plants. So affinity may be a good thing or a bad thing. Affinity may mean that lightning strikes here, fire starts, this will be immediately burned. Okay, or there is an epidemic starting out here, and this will be infected much more likely. This infection of C is much more likely than the infection of A, because there are many, many more paths of transmissions that can occur between B and C, or if this was fire. Obviously, B and C should be viewed as having higher affinity between them than A and B, because to go from A to B, you need to go through this bottleneck here, and there are very few paths. The number of paths is much smaller. So essentially, in this case, I would say the network of B and C are closer to each other because their social network here is much denser than between B and A. Although the geodesic distance, which is the shortest path it would take to go from here to here, is roughly the same between them. So geodesic distance is not necessarily a useful thing. This more of a probabilistic distance here, which tells me if something is to propagate between B and C, it's more likely to reach C in a given time than to reach A in a given time. And there are different notions of distances. The one they just defined is what is a good one. The other one would be maybe what would be the shortest time that something will propagate from B to C with probability larger than 1/10. That also is a good distance, and I'll maybe describe it in a few minutes. It's a different one than the one I have. So what happens when you take a, so I'm coming back to the globe example. This is another one of those. Let's take this image, 3D, image it from different direction again. It's identical problem to the microscopy problem. You image it in different orientations, you drop them all on the table, and you want to solve the puzzle, and that is organize all the images as they relate to each other. And so you look at this embedding, so you do exactly what I've done described before, look at the first two eigenfunctions, embed, and you find each image corresponds to two numbers, which is phi 1 and phi 2, and when you place the corresponding image on them, you get this particular picture, and you see that the parameters phi 1, phi 2 just essentially relate to the orientation of the image and relative to the thing. So this is a rudimentary cryomicroscopy project. I will skip this for a moment. Here is another example. And this, I think, is really the explanation of everything in some simple way. It's an observation made by Amit Singer that basically what we are doing here, in some sense, is a very, very beautiful generalization of calculus. So let me describe the problem. The problem is you have locations on the map of the US. And each location, what you know is its distance, say, to its 5 or 6 nearest cities. Okay? So for each location, you have a collection of distances around it that we know. So you have a local information about the configuration of that system. That local information describes the full geometry of a given city. You have the 5 cities around it. This whole geometry is known. So you can easily, if the city RI, you can easily write the city RI as basically a convex combination, as a center of mass, if you wish, of a few of its neighbors, maybe 6 or 7 neighbors around the city. So you get this matrix, which is a stochastic matrix, if the entries are positive. And you look at this equation, which is called the stress equation in this particular problem, and now you just have to really read it. Reading it just means that the x-coordinate of the vector ri, the point ri, is an eigenvector of this matrix applied to the x-coordinate, okay, with eigenvalue 1. The y-coordinate is an eigenvector of this matrix with eigenvalue 1. The constant function is also an eigenvector. So in particular, this, if you just read it, you realize that the coordinate x, y, x and y are in the eigenspace. So this matrix, it's a local matrix. For each point, you're just looking at a few neighbors. So this is local information. But it tells you the global solution about the map of the US, where the different cities are globally, is given in the eigenspace corresponding to eigenvalue 1 to this particular problem. So this is local variability, global solution. That's exactly what the fundamental theorem of calculus tells you. You know the variation of the function locally, get the function globally, you do some integration. Here, this is a two-dimensional integration, and you can use it to integrate. This was observed by Amit and Yossi Keller, that you can take any function in two dimensions. Let's say you have some function on the cities, and let's say you know their altitudes, and now you know the position now, and you also know the altitude of every city, say, or you know something, atmospheric pressure or something. But you really don't know the altitude, you just do the differential between the city and the next city. So you have a city, you know the difference between the altitude of that city and the nearest neighbors. You don't have other altitude measurements, let's say you do it by GPS or something. Then you could do the same thing to find out what the altitude of the whole US population is. So you're basically having the variation of the function, the gradient of the different cities locally, and you find the whole thing. So this is truly a generalization of calculus. It turns out you can do much more with this. You can solve differential equations, you can do all kinds of things. So in a way, what I'm saying here, so there are two paradigms here, okay? This is where I'm getting from. There is a one that says you have differential relations between things, how they are related, how each object is related to its neighbor. And then you get a global description of the whole population by eigenvectors of some operators which measure there. Okay? Or you can do it by another means, which is by local crawling, if you want, right? If I knew the distance between this and that, and then I can keep on measuring all the distances, or if I know the variation of a given function, well, I can add up variation along a path, and I get the variation between a point far away and a point close by, so by doing some sort of path integral. So there are two methods, right? The one is the sort of addition method, or building little incremental method, I would call it, and the other one is the global method of eigenvectors, okay? And so this brings me to this blend of those two methodologies, and so this is just my philosophy slide here before I go to some entertainment, which is basically this. In some sense, in mathematics, has been known for a long time. It starts basically with Zygmunt in the 30s last century, observing that using the eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator, which are the Fourier on the circle over the line, which are basically the Fourier functions, is an incredibly miraculous, powerful tool in order to expand function, to analyze them, to understand operators and analyze them. But it's such a general, powerful tool that you understand strictly nothing. Okay, it solved the problem, it's very nice, but what does it actually do is a total miracle. So Zygmunt already there, already 78 years ago, started to have this dream of combinatorial real variable methods, which I call here the bookkeeping method or the folder building method, to actually get to the same goals. And the theory evolved at that time called Littlewood-Paley theory, and now it's known as wavelet theory, which says that instead of expanding objects in eigenfunctions, you can expand them in simpler objects like wavelets or Haar functions or things of that sort, and you achieve a much better relation understanding geometrically. And this is occurring by, you build those functions by basically building folders on data. So besides this stuff, this is really what I was saying here. In the puzzle, solving the puzzle, you have two ways of doing it. The eigenfunctions give you a solution of the puzzle. The other one would be by building folders. So take a group of pieces, put them together, take the groups of groups, put them together, so hierarchically solve the thing this way. So this is sort of the analog of the wavelet paradigm. I see my puzzle has an extra S in it. Okay. So this was done, Mauro Maggioni and I built such wavelets on graphs, on data, and they were used to organize documents quite nicely. Unfortunately, the wavelets we built are too sophisticated, and again, they suffer from the same flaw of eigenfunctions. It's too much mathematics and not enough real basic nuts and bolts understanding. Aww. But it allows you to organize documents into folders very nicely. Here are the digit documents. They're organized into different folders embedded in a graph. You see different digits in different locations. So let me just very quickly here describe to you how one does that. First of all, this is just repetition of this distance between two points when you have some diffusion at time t. So you build folders by first of all extending the distance between points to a distance between sets. So if you have two sets E and F and you want to define a distance between them, you can basically define the affinity between two sets as a sum of affinity between the elements of the set F and the elements of the set E. This is integral notation, but it's really the sum of all affinities at time t between all elements here. This is affinity at time t between two sets. So once you have defined that, it becomes very easy. I'll describe it in words and skip about it. It's saying this: I'm going to take a point, look at all the ones, all the other points which have very high affinity to it, so very close by to it, and build a certain cluster. I'll take only path length, say, one. So all nearest neighbors, for example. And then I'll break everything into little clusters of nearest neighbors. Then I will define the distance or affinity between two clusters, E and F, by using this formula. I view my clusters as my elementary objects, and I now cluster the clusters into groups. I'm solving the puzzle. And I hierarchically build a collection of coarser and coarser graphs which go up. So let me skip this. Here is a very simple example of that. The points are distributed basically, there are four Gaussian clouds. And so this is done by basically agglomerating the points. So the first sort of high resolution, those are clusters at the first scale, and then I agglomerate them, so you see the two down here were agglomerated into a single one, and then I continue this agglomeration, so I go from here to here, to here, and to here. At this level, I actually got the four clusters. At this level, I get that. The problem with this construction is that it depends on a seed that you started out with. If I started by if I permuted my points and redid the construction, I'll get a slightly different folder structure on those points than I'm having here. And the issue is that whatever one wants to do, you need to randomize and sort of average your outcomes over the different folder structures. You have to have fuzzy folders. I mean, this is just a discrete systematic multi-scale partition of this particular set into subsets. So this is the full set is scales is the coarser scale. This is the finer scale, the next one. So scale here is basically by the diffusion among the points here. So it has nothing to do with the ambient Euclidean space. It has to do with the mutual relation between the various points. And I'll show you examples. But what I'm claiming here is that this is a way of actually very systematically building some language. So let me give you an example. My goal here was, I have raw data, I have this image, and the raw data is 8x8 sublocks of this image. The 8x8 sublocks of the image, except for the ones which are purely gray level, are the ones occurring here. They are really part, each sublock like this I view as a vector of data, and the issue is that's what the computer gets. Now the computer wants to build a worldview of the sensory input that it has. And it's done basically, there are really two parameters here. One is the ratio between black and white. The other one is orientation. When you map it with those eigenvectors, you see that there are two parameters. One is the black and white level, which is across here, and the orientation is along there. When you build, you do the multi-scale folder building of those things. Here is a folder on the finest scale. This folder, all the elements corresponding to a given folder, give me a little curvelet here, And here is a longer one at the next scale, and a full scale. So basically, the different folders can be viewed as geometric features in this set. OK, let me change which subjects completely. This is great. So this is the stuff that, did you give a talk here, Ido? OK, so I'll
what about this?
Not about this. OK, so this is work of Ido, Liberty, and Jim Bremer, and myself, and Steve Zucker, and various others. We were looking at the MMPI questionnaire. So you can view this MMPI questionnaire just as a gene database or anything you want. This is a Minnesota multiphasic psychological whatever. I don't know, what does the I stand for?
I think it's inventory.
Inventory, right. And this is a questionnaire of 570 questions that you ask people when they are prospective employees or when they have some psychological problems or whatever reasons, they may be in a prison or something. So you ask them, they have to answer the questionnaire. Based on the questions, on the responses, you have to be able to assess whether they have any issues, right? They may be hysterical, they may be depressive, they may be catatonic. There are lots of things that relate to their psychological states. And you want to deduce them from the questionnaire themselves, okay? Now, so this is a database. The database is basically given to us, and say we have, I don't know, 3,000 people, 500-something questions. Each question is plus one or minus one, whether the response is yes and no. And the question is, can we organize the database, not just the people or the question, but the combined database into an organization that will tell us, for a given person, whether the response, for example, that he gave is one that is to be expected, or maybe he's lying, or maybe he just miswrote it, or whatever it is. Okay. So the issue is that the database is a function. It's like an image, if you wish, where the inputs are the people and the question, and you want to be able to process that particular database, get it organized. But bear in mind, I'm going to describe to you what happened here without knowing anything, without reading a word. This is a collection of plus minus ones. And now you want to organize. So here is what happens when you, so actually, this is actually one way of organizing it. You project it into 2D in the first two eigenvectors. And the color here represents the scale for depression for the people. So you see that the organization is related to the geography, to basically the geography of the people in terms of their tabulation on this scatter plot. So each point here represents one person who responded. And the location here basically tells you something about their susceptibility to depression, if you wish. And you see that if you are down there in Florida, in the Keys, you'll be depressed. If you're out here in LA or something, or in San Francisco, you're being catatonic or something. So that's one way of seeing the geography. Actually, so I will describe demographic geography in a minute. So this is another way of organizing the people in which you basically look at, so what is the affinity between two people? Every person has a list of responses of plus minus one. And you basically say that you can define the affinity between them by seeing essentially how dependent the responses are between them, okay? So you do a Pearson test, for example, and if they are very dependent on each other, then you decide them as being very close to each other. That's more natural for questions. I will do the same thing on a question. You have two questions, and you can say, are those two questions dependent or independent across the population? You also do a Pearson test on that. Okay, so you can do a Pearson test on the people, Pearson test on the questions, and you basically define the affinity if the two people are very closely responses are very close to each other. In other words, you have a high probability of predicting the response of the second person knowing the first. You can also look at mutual information if you wanted to. And then you take a diffusion. I think we took lengths, T was 18 here. And then you display that thing. You find the population is organized in this sort of croissant-shaped object. And again, the depressive state is out here. The catatonic state is out here. When I say catatonic, as people who reply to everything one, yes, or everything no. The color is just is the depression scale of the people. It's not a diagnosis, it's a scale. Which means basically that people pick out of the 500 questions, maybe 50 questions, that really relate directly to depression, and they build an empirical scale, linear classifier based on that. And that's how it's called. That's a good question. I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, in terms of the responses, obviously. By the way, you should not be misled by this kind of picture. There are other dimensions. Okay. So we are not really measuring in all dimensions. When we go to music in a minute, you will see that we have to do things in 100 dimensions and not in two or three dimensions. Those miracles are an oversimplified version of the universe. So here, but in any case, you see, it's quite easy to see that the geography here, in some sense, so you can take this, think of this thing, and you can split it into different demographics. So think of a block here of a given size as being a demographic of people, and you see that you will have different demographics in terms of depression scores as you go along. In fact, it turns out that all other psychological issues are pretty well organized geographically in this demographic. So this is a geographic atlas of state of mind, if you wish, as far as it's seen from this particular question. I would say that Ido here observed that normally, by the way, with those questionnaires, if, say, 20% of the questions are not, there's no response on them, they usually throw it away. Ido demonstrated that you can throw away 50% of the questions and basically fill in with high reliability all the rest of it. There's so much redundancy and dependence between them that you really don't need all of that. By the way, you can throw out all 50 questions which relate to depression, and you can still get the score of depression. Okay, now that's really important because people usually lie. Okay, if it's an interview for a job and they're smart and you have a question that obviously relates to your state of mind, they will respond in the way that they think your prospective employer wants you to respond, right? And so they're usually lying for that. And so this is quite critical to be able to evaluate a questionnaire in which the questions are sort of innocuous, they're unrelated to the problems, so to speak, right? So it's critical whether you do it for this or for alcohol abuse or for whatever. Okay? You need, or basically you're interrogating somebody at the airport to see if there's a terrorist. You need to have innocuous questions, and you need to have this preponderance of paths that tell you that if you responded to all those questions, then it's likely that you would respond in some very specific way. So this is just the organization of the people. Now let's talk about the questionnaire itself. Okay. So again, we can also embed, and now this is more interesting and has a completely different geometric structure. If we look at the people themselves, and at the questions themselves, and build a graph of the questions by basically saying two questions have high affinity if, when you apply the Pearson test, they're extremely dependent on each other. Let's say you get 0.9 or 0.99 for Pearson. I don't remember what the parameters is. And again, you diffuse for sufficient long time. Then in some coordinates, this will depend on coordinates, and I will elaborate on that. We'll run it in a minute. In some coordinates, you look at patches like this, which will be folders. And you ask yourself, what are such patches that actually occur? And you find out this particular folder obviously relates to job and gender. Right. I mean, it's quite clear that this is all the people basically who responded to that have what basically females, and that's something having to do with that. So here is another group in another projection in some other dimensions, which is down there, this particular sticks. It turns out that sticks like this correspond to topics. They correspond to various eigenfunctions of this, which are concentrated on the cluster or on a subset in responses. So here you see those are all related to fear. Okay. No fear of water, I have a great fear of snakes, I'm not afraid of mice, I do not worry about catching disease. I mean, by the way, the questioner doesn't know yes or no, right? I mean, so this is a random, the yes or no thing is a random choice. That was set in the way the question was written. I'm not saying that you cannot reorient the questionnaire, okay, so that two highly related questions will have the same polarity. That's a possibility. So in other words, it would be either yes or no. So, so here, if I write two questions, the people who don't worry, who are not afraid of mice, don't worry about anything. And this is just some sort of level of psychological excitement.
Yeah,
I feel so full of pep that sleep is not necessary. Okay, for a day at a time, that's... Well, obviously, but you see, the point is, if you answer that, you answer that, you answer that, all of them are extremely consistent across the population. Okay, so the issue is really... Okay, so here what I've done is this. Looked at the rows of the matrix, organized the rows. Looked at the columns of the data matrix, organized the columns. You really want to blend the two organizations, and the folder building that you build on one is to be related to the folder building you build on the other. Okay. So this is, now I'll display some examples of this concept, let me do it here, which are essentially academic just to explain this thing. So suppose I started with a data matrix, which is this matrix here. It's a zero everywhere, and then the gray level correspond to the values, and the folder structure here is already organized. Okay, so this is somebody, an oracle gave me the data organized. Okay, the data organized came like this. And then somebody came and screwed it all up. You permuted all the rows and then permuted all the columns. And so this beautiful matrix is the way the data comes. This is how it comes in the real world. When I have the people, they have no structure on them. When I have the questions, somebody just dropped them in the questionnaire. So the issue is, this is what we get. And somehow we want to recover that. Okay. What is the advantage here is, all we know is that all the people in this folder have, and all the questions on those topics had the same response. Right. All the people, all the questions on this topic are much more detailed in terms of people folders. Each one of those folders of people gave a different, the same response. And the same thing here, all the people here, well, had a uniform response. All of those folders are non-informative. Okay? So the issue, but this is the way you get the stuff, that's the way you want to get it. Okay, so there is a very beautiful search algorithm, which is very fast, that allows you to organize this matrix as a collection, as a sum of collection of submatrices. Okay, first of all, which basically, so you take this matrix here, this is all the columns, organize them into folders, two columns go into the same folder if they very resemble each other very much, so they have high affinity or basically a high Pearson test. Okay, so you accumulate them together, and otherwise, and then you build a folder structure hierarchically, so you have big folder, small folder, and different scale. You do the same thing with the topics of the questions. You build them that way. And then you ask yourself, can I break this whole up so that all the people in here will have essentially a uniform response in here? Okay, well, uniform response is not necessarily the case. It should be maybe rank one or something, so they have the same profile. And you want to basically break up the matrix into blocks so that each block is in some sense the simplest possible you can have, and you have to have, this is a partition of the database into products of demographics. You have a demographic here, so that each block is the simplest possible. So simplest would be a constant, or simplest could be the rank of each block should be minimal, so that the profile is identical, one vector profile per block. Okay, but different blocks have different profiles. If you could do that, you're step one to do amazing organization of databases, which is everything under the sun, right? So this, as I said, this could be genes and abstracts, or it could have as many axes as you want here, right? You can have third axis, fourth axis, and one goes through the algorithm. This is an application of that principle, which is really physical, which is you have charges, you have here emitters. So this is a coil. On each location of the coil, you have, let's say, an acoustic field which is being emitted. It's being measured out here on a plate. The matrix that you have is you have emitter, you have sensor. So it's like having questions and answers, okay? And the issue is how do you organize the whole system into a product, into different folders. This is sometimes called Calderon-Zygmunt type decomposition, but it comes by basically data analysis. And okay, let me now actually go to the real, okay, so let me actually do that. So here, so let me tell you the setting of that. We're going to run it. 40, yeah, that's okay. So what you see here is this. This is a collection. So the data here is a collection of audio segments, or each, or 10 seconds each, coming out from Fred Warner's musical collection. He has about 10,000 tracks. And we took a few hundred, about 100 different segments in each one of the tracks. This is like, think of each track as a book. Think of each segment of 10 seconds as a page of the book. And so here we are having a library of books, a database of books. We look at all the pages, and we ask ourselves, at this point, let's just organize the pages by their affinity. So each page has some vocabulary. In this case, it's audio. So the vocabulary involves a certain collection of spectral features, temporal features, and so on. So we have about 400, 500 features like that. And then we organize the graph of that collection here. And again, as you can see, I'm taking 100 eigenvectors. They're absolutely necessary, which I'm going to show you. Because the different folders of music that pop out are really those little sticks that we have seen in the questions before. And so here is, I clicked on this one, and it gave me this collection of music. And you see, it's not particularly interesting. It's this guy, which you can hear. Not very interesting, right? Well, it ends up, but you see, or maybe extremely interesting. It's okay, but it goes like this. It goes down here. Obviously, it hits Frank Sinatra, and that's sort of the. So it goes pretty far out of field. But it's essentially vocal sync. Let me go to another folder here. Okay, so I picked this other stick here. They're different people. Thank you. let's take this one. Okay, so. Okay, this is a lot of them coming out of the same thing. It goes further out of the field. Right? Does a pretty decent job. You're not specifying ahead of time what it is that you're looking for, right? You're just saying, here it is, this is my database. Here are the different topics, if you wish, just like we did with the questionnaire. It looks almost identical to what we had with the questionnaire. And it pulls for you those thematic sticks out of there, right? That's sort of like, and you need to go. As you see, I'm in coordinates 40, 41, and 42 here. I can go down to the other coordinates. And it gets a little blurry. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Okay,
yeah,
sure. How do you pick those coordinates? I mean, is there...
Oh, so what are the eigenvectors?
I understand, but
okay.
From seeing these interesting pictures that you're picking up, you went to 41, 42, and 43 because...
I went to the first 100.
Right.
Because it turns out I can reduce how many dimensions I want to look at in terms of measuring the distance between them, okay?
Sure.
And how many parameters I want to have in the same. The reason that there are so many dimensions in there has to do with the following thing. What they're really, there are lots of very connected groups which have very narrow strands. It's sort of like the vegetation situations that I have, okay? In this kind of situation, you'll have eigenvectors which are concentrated on the various thematic groups, if you wish. And since there is at least 100, there are 10,000 songs and tracks in here, and there are quite a bit of variability in the system.
So I think he's asking how you automate the selection of triplets.
Exactly. I mean, when the dimensions become very high, I mean...
Oh, you shouldn't do it that way. This is crap. Okay. I mean, all right, that's not how it should
be. Well, not automated, but how did you... I mean, when dimensions become very high, you have to obviously have an idea of where the interesting aspects of what you looked at.
What you look at. But basically, you could... first of all, you don't need this display at all, right? I mean, you basically just can do this construction that I've described, which is a multi-scale diffusion construction. And that will give you the different folder. So the way you want to represent, if you wish, this particular information is not by using eigenfunctions at all. I don't think that's the right way of doing it. If I can build a music folder structure, then, and I have a little track, I say how it relates to the different folders as a way of saying, well, here is a very rhythmic thing, and here is a very jazzy thing, and here is a vocal thing, and it's the distance to those three is such and such. I mean, the affinity to the three is a triangulation type affinity. This is the kind of thing Peter was talking about as a way of getting affinity coordinate or triangulation coordinates on the data set. It's much more informative. I mean, using the eigenfunction as coordinates is beautiful mathematically, useless if you want to tell people what it is that you got, right? So you're better off telling people, well, this particular music track or a music segment has a little bit of those features, a little bit of those features. Sort of defining feature genres, if you wish, which are the different folders. I mean, genre is the folder, right? And so but this allows you to automatically define the genres as you go along.
Rafi, just so we understand what you're showing us. So when you show us the folders, are those computed from the full 100 eigen functions, or are they computed just from the tree that you?
Here it's. I've done nothing. Okay, I've not developed a tree or anything. This is the most rudimentary algorithm. You look at all the data that's out there. You define a diffusion distance between it, okay, and you build a graph by using the top 100 eigenvectors. Okay, now here I projected on 3, 1, and 12. Okay. As a general rule, as I say, when you see those sticks coming out, they're basically a folder. Each one of them is a topic. So let's just.
That I understand, but the folders you actually have down in the list.
Oh, no, what I have down the list right here. You see, I just picked something. You see my name? This is one long monster 20-minute track. Okay, they're all coming out of that track. Everything that was selected here was in a bowl of some. I looked at the number of neighbors in that particular.
In the 100.
In this 100-dimensional space, scaled by eigenvalue, and diffusion time corresponding to roughly this.
And so the 3 is just a way to visualize a particular aspect of this.
Yeah, this is actually 2D, right? So it's really 1 and 3.
Mm-hmm. So if you, for example, clicked on something that's in the middle there, which might be on a.
Oh, you won't see anything. Right, let's do that.
It might be on a string and some other thing that you don't have.
Yeah, so it's completely different, right? So let me center it here. Make it the center. You may want to look at it in 3D. Okay? So you see, I'm still in the center. It's going to be much harder to see. Let's see what happens. But get confused for two reasons, which I'll explain to you. There is some instrumental and some. I have to explain something. You see, on the other hand, it's much more homogeneous in regions like that. In the center, you have to sort of peel it out and relate it to the sticks that come out of it.
Rafi,
yeah.
So what is what are the colors represent? These dots, greens and blues.
They represent the different the original folder organization that Fred has.
I see.
Okay.
Yes. So quickly, what was the diffusion distance between two segments of music? Maybe I missed what you said, but so you have a distance measure for.
Yeah, I define it. So let's say you look at the exponential that I have there, and you take this matrix, which is a matrix on the data. Now you iterate this matrix, say, 20 times. That gives you the time parameter, which is out here. Okay? And that gives you the diffusion, the diffusion of all paths of length 20. What I really should say is critical is that this distance based on diffusion is looking, does not just, so distance based on diffusion is not just you take a point, you take another point, and you decide something. If you're looking at the whole body of evidence that you have, okay, and you're saying based on this body of evidence and based on all of the paths of evidence which connect this to that, okay, I imagine the distance is small if there is a high probability of diffusing from this point to that. So it's basically completely subjective to the database. It's not an objective Euclidean distance. It has nothing to do with that. Okay? It's a subjective distance defined by your database. So the distance that Fred's music defines is totally subjective to this test, okay? To the database that he collected. Okay? And there's nothing objective about it. And in fact, how to do objective-subjective distances is really key.